Welcome to Sacred Legions. I'm Max Goller.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Pat, we had the honor of attending the opening of this film in Indianapolis just over a year ago. So I looked it up today, August 20th of 2024, we were watching this film. And I found that film so incredibly impactful. And it's my honor today to have not just one, but two secular saints being represented from A Better Vision Films. And it's Don Sawyer and Tim Hashko. Welcome to Sacred Legions.
Thank you.
You're our first co-saints. So that's kind of exciting.
Co-saints.
You're our co-saints. We usually have a secular saint and a saintly sidekick. You guys are both secular saints, so it's pretty impressive. We've got to polish halos for both of you. So people are coming to understand from our podcast that a secular saint, it was a phrase coined by Kurt Vonnegut, pertaining to people who behave decently in an indecent time. When you guys started out, it was already pretty indecent, but boy, has it gotten worse. So first of all, tell us, as Max was alluding to your film but not naming it, the first film we're going to talk about, because you have two really important, really pretty much for folks who need, who get a chance to see these films, they could be life-changing films that, that are coming out. But the first one is about homelessness. Let's start with Don. Don, give us the title of the film and a brief description.
Beyond the Bridge, A Solution to Homelessness is the name of the film. It is a film that shows that any community, no matter how big or small it is, anywhere from Los Angeles to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, can apply this formula that's shown in the film, and they can devastate their homelessness numbers. They can, if not in homelessness in their community, they can get it very much under control. And that solution has a, you know, you work within one homeless response system, you place the homeless response system upon a foundation of housing and services, but that alone, housing and services alone, cannot do it. What really ends homelessness is a community collaborative effort, meaning law enforcement, judicial system, nonprofit service providers, the mayor's administration or county executive, or preferably both, healthcare system, faith community, normal citizens, business community, everybody alert and working and doing their part with their little corner, working together to end homelessness, and anybody can do it.
Yeah. And so just as a caveat, so I don't get 1,000 phone calls from my fellow advocates who are going to rip me to shreds, that we're talking about chronic homelessness for individuals. We're not talking about family homelessness. We're not talking about
all of it.
Well, we should be talking about all of it. We should be. But the homelessness that is plaguing families with children and stuff like that, they don't get Housing First, which is the name of this program, applied to them in the same way.
That is the problem with, and it's not a problem when we're on the ground in communities. We get rid of that perception within 3 minutes of being with people. We're talking about one homeless response system that encompasses everyone. And if you're homeless, if a family becomes homeless, like for example, in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, we had an event there. It's a community of 70,000 people. 600 people showed up at the screening, and the head of the Chamber of Commerce looked at that and said, if our citizens care this much about this, we need to do something. So they set the table that we recommend, which is a table where all the people, the movers and shakers, the decision makers, sit at on a consistent basis. They're once a month or once every 2 weeks, and they hammer out the roadmap to take every population from homeless to house. So it's all Housing First principles, because Housing First says no barriers. So if a family is evicted, you know, that's on the record. Nobody's going to house them. If they're in a Housing First program, that eviction goes away. So this friend of ours who is a service provider in Eau Claire was serving 30 families. And as a matter of this new program in their community, they have infused her with the capacity to house 100, and that's at scale, 100 families, and they took it to scale. And she runs a housing first model. So any community that we see that's successfully dealing with homelessness, they may start with the chronic that's sleeping on the street. But like Milwaukee, Wisconsin has reduced overall homelessness 42%.
Okay, so let me back up just for a second. If you're listening, what you may not be knowing yet is this show is not available on a streaming service. And this movie is not available if you just want to go see Beyond the Bridge. You're not going to be able to just watch it. You go town to town with your film, and you have these I just want to explain what you're explaining.
Okay.
So people get the background of it. Right. You go town to town when towns call you up and they say, hey, guys, we want to see your film. We understand that you explain that saying to people, we can't fix your problems while you're still in utter crisis. We got to at least get a roof over your head. And then whatever other things are contributing to your homelessness, we can start chipping away, but we can't do it while you're still in your car. So you go town to town and you meet with these policymakers and you have them on stage and you have these conversations about your film. And so that's the first thing. If people, after they hear this, they want to see the film, they're going to need to reach out to you. Tim, how do they get a hold of you if somebody hears this and wants this film in their community?
Well, we have a website, asolutionhomelessness.com. And on it, we have all the information. You know, we have all the upcoming events. As soon as we lock them in, we add it to the website. There's a request a screening form. But usually, we don't even know how communities find us, to be honest. We get all these requests from all over the country. And sometimes they will have seen the movie at a different event. Other times, they will just have heard of it from somebody who has seen it. You know, they reach out to us. They explain what it is that they're looking for. And then we get on Zoom, usually the first quick kind of like chat on Zoom just to get an idea of their vision, what they're looking for. And then if they are, you know, excited enough and interested enough to start doing the, you know, the prep, the building of the steering committee and to get other partners involved in it, then we just take it, you know, we take it all the way. And then hopefully a couple of months down the road, we show up in person and there's a room full of, you know, 500 regular old citizens just from the general public, and then all the necessary stakeholders in the room sitting together, watching the movie, learning how two communities in the film did it, and how they in their community can do it as well. So that's kind of like in a nutshell, the overview of how it happens.
How long do you guys expect the impact campaign? How many cities have you been to now with this?
It's an interesting question because when we first started, we were doing our own official tour where we would take on all the responsibility, the planning and the financial burden of an event. And our goal was to do 40 of those all around the country. And we've done about half of that. I think technically 18. We did 21, but then 3 didn't happen for various reasons. There was a tornado in Nashville that, you know, canceled the event. Anyway, so we did 18 of those. But what happened along the way, we started getting all these additional requests from, like I said, all over the country. We have like 210 different communities reach out up to this point. And so now we're doing this kind of like official tour, but also doing this side show, so to speak, where the community takes more of the responsibility of the planning, the financial burden and all that. We still guide them. We still participate in the process, but it's more on them. So to answer your question, we did 18 official, but then there's been quite a few. I think we're about 50 something total screenings around the country up to this point. And the campaign, you know, we were going to do it for 1 year, but the demand is so high. We're doing it the second year and then, you know, so through spring of next year for sure, and then we'll see what happens afterwards.
So there are so many aspects of this to talk about. I do know that last week or the week before, in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the last county closed its waiting list for housing. So every single county in Pennsylvania now has a closed waiting list. They will not take, they will not add anyone to the list because of the chaos in Washington. So I am almost heartened to hear that people still want you there, because with them rolling out troops in DC and all the other things that they're doing to criminalize homelessness and everything since Grant's pass forward in the Supreme Court, we know that it's cheaper to house people than it is to criminalize homelessness or send people to hospitals or whatever the flavor of the month for the solution is. And basically what you guys show in your film is that here are real life people experiencing homelessness, and here's what happens when they get home. And it's a beautiful story, right? So if we back up a little bit from the chaos we have now, and we go back up to you guys making the film, let's go back to why you're secular saints and get to the bottom of this. And Don, you're also you're not just unique because you're a co-saint in this event, but you're also unique because you're our first family member who has saints in their family, because we interviewed your mom and your sister as civil rights secular saints. So we're honored to have you here for that reason also. But you're both really talented guys. You're really smart. You're really talented. You could be doing anything with your time that isn't worrying about homelessness and worrying about people who have nothing. So Don, how come you're not playing music in LA right now, which you have done over your career, you know? How come you're focusing on people who no one else cares about, or very few people?
Well, you know, I actually get that a lot. I mean, especially when, you know, the famous question, why do you care? You know, that kind of thing. People are suspicious. And my whole thing is just the way I'm wired is why, how can you not care? I mean, what's wrong? You know, it's very natural to care. And of course, I grew up in a family that was always looking to help the less fortunate than we were. But there was an incident, and, you know, we lived in Kenya when I was 9, and there was an incident in the village that we lived in where we had to, people were starting to get antsy in the village because we would never show up at this daily social event to be seen. You know, why are the new Americans not joining us? You know, so my mom dressed us up and took us out, and we stood on a cliff while everybody was walking up and down the road. And that's what the social thing was. And across on another cliff were these kids that were skinny as rails, except their stomachs were big. Mm-hmm. And I said to my mom, I said, those kids are fat. And my mom, for the first time and only time in my life, slapped me. And she said, those kids are not fat because they eat too much. Those kids are fat because they don't have enough to eat. And I look back over at those kids, and my little 9-year-old mind said, well, that's not right. I've never had a hungry day in my life. So that poverty has never been invisible to me from that moment on. And I always feel something when I drive by and I see somebody, you know, on the street or anything. And so when I was in LA, when I lived in LA, I used to go down to Skid Row and just pass out food and clothes, but I didn't know anything about the dynamics of homelessness, why it existed. I just did it because people were hurting. And then moved to Indianapolis and happened to get a teacher named Maurice about the real homeless situation. And then I just kind of got outraged about the whole deal. And here I am.
And that was something that inspired your first film, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because, you know, you've got Beyond the Bridge, but you had that initial film that was directed towards Indianapolis.
Yeah, that was the first film. I was down at the homeless camp where Maurice was a resident and also running it like a program for the people who didn't fit in the shelters or any of the other programs. So he ran his own. He had about 80 people in the camp at its height. And so I would just go down there. I would hang out. I would, you know, occasionally give money. You know, they got to know me in the camp. And then these kids came down with cameras. They wanted to do a documentary, and long story short, myself and those young guys became a film crew documenting a story of criminalization where the city just bulldozed their camp and gave them nowhere to go. It was tragic. It was awful. And at that point, I was pissed. And so we made a pretty pissed off movie.
Which I might add is the best movie ever on homelessness. Your current film is phenomenal. Not taking anything away from that. But I met you because of that film. Someone from Indianapolis called me and said, there's a guy out here in Indianapolis making a lot of trouble. He's been filming people. And the people that you were making trouble with wasn't the people experiencing homelessness. It was the community leaders.
Yep.
Who were talking to you like you were their best friend and spilling their beans about how all of this was just kind of part of the plan, you know, getting rid of these people, and they've got their limits on who they're going to help. And you got people fired, not intentionally, but just because they spoke so candidly to you. And then you put your film out and the axe fell on these morons who just disclosed their utter contempt for people experiencing homelessness, which was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, Don, and I will forever be grateful to you. So I reached out to you to interview you for the Huffington Post because I thought you were the best thing since sliced bread. The other best thing since sliced bread was dating my daughter at the time, which is Tim Hashko.
Oh.
And I love people. I mean, I know Max because we had a random meeting, and Kurt has something to say about that, right? Pay attention to your random Kurt Vonnegut. And so I wanted Don in my life. I was had to keep him forever because of this amazing thing he did. So I invited him to the house for spaghetti and meatballs, and it happened to be Tim's house because he was dating my daughter. And so, Tim, why don't you tell us about, you had a great job. You had you were working, producing your own videos. You were working for a huge company that was working on cervical cancer and flying you to Australia. And you had all of these opportunities. And now you care about people. Tell us why you don't do all those. Other.
Yeah. Well, at the time, I think the cervical cancer was at the time. I think the year was what, early 2015. At the time, I was kind of like building my business, my video production thing, mostly just doing corporate gigs, you know, like advertising, just normal routine, you know, whatever people do in these days. I was supplementing some of that with working at a restaurant downtown Indianapolis. Just at nights. So I come home after my serving shift and, you know, on my couch sits this strange fella, Don Sawyer, eating meatballs. What was going on?
They
here?
Were good meatballs, by the way.
Yeah, epic meatball dinners of Pat LaMarche. You know, you told this story. So, you know, I heard that story. You know, Don is doing this thing about homelessness and blah, blah, blah. And as he was leaving, I suggested to him, well, you know, why don't we just hang, you know, meet up for coffee, see if there's anything we can work on together. And, you know, we met up sometime later, and one thing leads to another. We do a little project here, a little project there. And then a year later, you know, we find ourselves working together full time. You know, I became, at that point, I helped him finish the previous film, Under the Bridge, The Criminalization of Homelessness. And then we started working full time as a documentary crew. We went to Massachusetts. We had a gig there for a handful of months. And then afterwards, 2017, I think, is when we decided. Oh, what happened is that we're sitting there one day. You know, I just became a United States citizen. And I just, because of working with Don, started thinking of myself as a kind of like a documentary filmmaker who can not just shoot corporate videos, but also produce larger scale projects that have more meaning behind them for the larger society. And so I just became a citizen. I'm thinking to myself, you know, Don, I really would like, well, I'm thinking out loud with Don, I really would like for to do something meaningful, you know, this big, do a big project that could contribute to my new country in a positive way. So why don't we, you know, figure something out together? And we started talking. We talked about Under the Bridge, doing a follow-up to it. Under the Bridge was based in Indianapolis. However, the problem of the criminalization was so vast all around the country, that movie was actually very popular all around the country. And a lot of communities wanted us to come there and do a follow, you know, kind of like cover this issue of criminalization on a nationwide scale, which would have been an easy thing to do, you know. Mm-hmm. And now even more easy, you know, even easier. Mm-hmm. But we talked about it and we decided that actually we weren't the one who decided it. When we were showing on the bridge at a few screenings around the country at that time, people would just tell us, you know, hey, great film. Thank you for pointing out the problem. But what do you think? What do you suggest we do? How do we solve it? What's the solution to homelessness? And we didn't know that. So that's how we were like, okay, let's do a movie not about pointing out the problem on the larger scale, but rather focus on the solutions to the problem. So that's how that whole thing started. But why is it that I'm doing that instead of other things that could, you know, pay more money? Well, you know, whatever it would. You know, I got to be honest. When I first came to America, that was like late 90s, early 2000s, my early years here. I was like most people in the United States who look at the homeless people and say, they just, they're lazy. They can't, you know, they just need to get a job and all the usual, you know, it's all their fault. Because I came to America, I was working at Arby's at the time. I was going to school. I was making it work with, you know, with almost no effort in my mind. It was happening for me. Right. And so I thought that that's those people's problem, you know, they had to figure it out. But as time went on and I started, you know, just learning the history of different, you know, just learning the history and meeting people and meeting Don and meeting you, Pat, I realized that it's not as simple as that. There's a lot of, you know, hidden layers behind this issue.
Wait, can I ask you a quick question? Were you surprised when you got here to find out that people don't have health care?
I don't think I even knew at that time that they didn't have, you know, at the time I was living in an environment where most people had a job and most, you know, like a normal, whatever, middle-class job. And those jobs back then provided some sort of a healthcare insurance coverage. So I didn't think that was a problem at the time. Later, I realized that it was a problem. Yeah, I just didn't know that. But then, of course, yeah, later on, of course, I'm like, well, it makes no sense.
So, but as a person who came from a former Soviet bloc country, you just assumed that people in America all have healthcare.
Yeah, I heard all the great hits about America. American healthcare is amazing if you can get to it, if you can afford it. I mean, the things that the innovations, the, you know, the research, everything is just unbelievable. But also at the same time, a person who doesn't have sufficient healthcare or no healthcare can find themselves in a situation where they become completely broke. They lose everything, and then they end up living in a tent or under a bridge. And we've interviewed so many people, and that story is so ridiculously common that it just makes no sense to me. Yes, it's an amazing system, but for some reason, there's a lot of people who can't get it, who can't make it work for them.
Yeah, when I was running for office, and I would talk about healthcare, I used to say America doesn't have the best healthcare; it has the most extreme. It has you can get a prosthetic device that your brain talks to and moves your hand. You know, I mean, just such extreme quality of improved life. Or you can have absolutely nothing and you can die of a curable thing because our healthcare system is so extreme. So I want to shift. I think we could talk about this issue forever. I can't recommend enough that people see this film. Let's go back to Under the Bridge. That's available for free out there, right, in the global World Wide Web. So people can look for Under the Bridge, Don Sawyer, Tim Hashko, watch that film. I cannot recommend it enough. It's mind-blowing and eye-opening to a degree. You will see Maurice, who we all love and miss desperately. He like almost everyone who experiences chronic homelessness, died way too young. Public Health Department in New York City says the average person who experiences chronic homelessness loses 30 years of a life. They die 30 years earlier. So there are so many things that come out in your new film about race and other issues that are so important in homelessness that People need to see your new film, but they can see Under the Bridge right away today. After this, they can just go watch it. But I want to move to your second big project, if I can, which is another old friend of all of ours who sadly has passed, Dan Wakefield. And because you didn't think that enough people would hate you for talking about homelessness, you decided to take on wokeness and what it's like to wake up an old white guy. So, I don't know, we all met Dan Wakefield because of Max Goller, the hub of the wheel, who was working at the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library. And Dan, of course, as an old friend of Kurt Vonnegut's, was there all the time helping any way he could. He introduces us to Dan, and we find out that he's this multidimensional dude who just at the time of taping, just 3 days ago, was the 80th anniversary or 70th anniversary of the killing of Emmett Till. And he was at that trial for the Nation magazine. So we all meet him and we're making a little, 15-minute video with Tim about this friend of Kurt Vonnegut's for the Kurt's Karass little film series we made. And we realized this is bigger. And Don joins our little club of spaghetti and meatball eating with Dan Wakefield. And Don, explain this. So you decide to take this white guy and use an example of how white people can learn. So is that a fair assumption or description? Or
I think Tim has a lot to do with how that film. See, what happened was during COVID, Dan, like many older people, was going down. He was getting very depressed because he was a social animal and he couldn't be social. And, so I would have meals with him and he would simply tell me the most incredible stories in his depression. So there was no filters. And he would just tell me all of these incredible things. Like he was a shepherd in Israel, sleeping on a hill and tending sheep. And he's just telling me matter-of-factly. And I'm like, why would you do that? And he said, well, because I think Baldwin told it, either Baldwin or Murray Kempton told him, if you want to be an author, you need to have life experiences. So I just figured I'd go do that.
Baldwin, you mean James Baldwin?
Yeah, James Baldwin, yeah. And he just tell me all kinds of stuff. And I was like, well, this has to be document. I mean, like, because it looks like he's about to go. So before he goes, we need to get this on this recorded. So I asked him, if he would like to do that. And he was like, oh, sure. And he was very depressed at the time. He said, sure, I'll do it. And so we started doing that. And he was all over the place. It wasn't focused on anything. It was just focused on everything. And I was wondering how we were going to make a film out of his, like Gulliver's Travels or something, like just big, this big, big thing. And Tim said, and we were overwhelmed at the moment. And he said, well, why don't we just do it on this article that he wrote, which was how an old white guy got woke. And it was very concise. It was very movie ready, as it turns out. And it was also kind of a pre-warm-up of a big film that we wanted to do on racism. It was kind of a warm-up. So that's what we did. I took it to Dan, and he was very, very cantankerous at that time. He was like, well, you do something. I don't know, like this. And then the next time, so I wasn't sure he was in on it. And the next time I saw him, he said, well, I thought you were going to do it on the article. And I was like, okay, well, that's, I guess he bought it, right? So that's how we ended up doing that.
For people, this is unfortunately, this is audio and you can't see all of our faces as we smile at this remembrance of Dan. Because cantankerous is the perfect word, but he was also the most loving and supportive author I've ever met. I've never met another author who works as hard and as tirelessly to help other authors succeed. And our inaugural guest on this program, Christina Jarvis, is another of those authors that Dan was like, let me make phone calls on your behalf. Let me help you. He got me in the Authors Guild. He would do anything and everything he could for someone else. And so it really illustrates how absolutely lonesome and disconnected he had become from the world, that he was, you guys were offering him what he wanted more than anything, which was a biopic, right? Or biopic, or however they say that word, about his life and the importance he had from New York in the 50s, which is titled one of his books, and going through to his amazing relationship with James Baldwin that ended in tragedy in his life, a tragic moment of Dan Wakefield's life, and all of these important things. And you guys are offering him a chance for that immortality. And he's like Snippy, you know, because Snippy was, you know, sort of the go-to. And, you know, and you know, in order to, if you knew Dan Wakefield, you know that in order to really get what you wanted out of him, you had to, you know, sort of drag him down to the Red Key and buy him a glass of red wine, and then you were it, right? So, Tim, tell us about this film that you guys are doing now. You're sort of final edit stages?
Well, we are, okay, so the film is titled How an Old White Guy Got Woke. And I think we are going to keep the title despite the word woke. Or maybe not despite, but because of it being very toxic. That's kind of like our specialty. You know, we do a film heavily about housing first, a very toxic term, turns out. But we stick to it and we explain what it is and what it isn't. So the same with woke. Certain political forces that like to hijack these terms and make them, you know, what they become. So the movie is about Dan Wakefield's awakening journey on race issues. We are currently we have a rough cut. So we're close. The only thing is that we're using so much archival photos and videos and music from all eras of the 20th century, you know, James Baldwin, Emmett Till stuff, you know, that we have to, it's expensive. I mean, we're compiling a big spreadsheet of how much we need to raise to pay up for all the licensing. And it's going to be like, I don't know, over 100,000, 150,000, what we need. So that's what we are. We're just in the kind of like fundraising stage to lock it in, to license everything, and then it'll be out.
And so 150,000 for a big granting facility, that might not be a lot of money. It sounds like a lot to us, right? Are you looking for individual donations? Is there a place somebody can help out? Or are you looking for, you know, those names you hear at the end of a story on public broadcasting?
We hope to do a fundraiser, fundraising screening soonish in Indianapolis. Can like show that rough cut to everybody who loved Dan and beyond. We will take any donations we can, but what we found from making the first film is that little donations, they help, but it's the big foundations who really step in. That's when it, or big private donors who step in and it can make it really. Yeah. Cause 150,000 from even everybody who loved Dan, if they were there, you know, that would have to be, you know, everybody would have to chip in like, I don't know, $1,000 each for it to happen, you know?
Yeah.
And when is that screening going to take place in Indianapolis?
It's just, we don't have specifics yet. We're just kind of like talking, but we think in November, right, Don?
Yeah, November, probably sometime in November.
Wow, that's pretty soon, though. That's kind of exciting. Yeah. I mean, for those of us who were at Dan's funeral, too, I mean, there were an awful lot of people there that just, he meant the world to, and person after person, you included, Don, got up and spoke about how he just reached an arm out and said, come along and let's be a part of this, which he was very, just so inclusive. So it would be really exciting to see all those people, you know, be able to pay it forward a little to get his film out, even if they're just rolling in the credits at the very end, right? To know that they did that and back, I think that'll be important. Obviously, we want to know the date and help promote it as much and get there. So, what is life like as filmmaking saints? I mean, you've got these two issues that, like what you said, Tim, you take these toxic terms and throw them back at people and say, well, no, housing first isn't toxic. It's putting a roof over somebody's head. And your idea is actually the toxic one, which is throw them in jail, right? That's a pretty toxic answer. And then secondly, becoming woke is a gift. Tim, you have in the past, I don't want to put you on the spot. You can say no, but you have done that first sentence he wrote from memory for the Emmett Till trial when he was down there and he had so many experiences. Do you know it off the top of your head again?
Yeah, the best sentence that Dan ever wrote was the very first sentence in his career when he went down to the Emmett Till trial in Sumner, Mississippi. That was a 5-day trial for those. I'm surprised that not many people know the facts of the case. You know, I've recently posted something on Facebook and, Emmett Till brutally murdered a 14-year-old African-American boy who came from Chicago down to Mississippi, was brutally allegedly whistled at the white woman. And then her husband and his half-brother came and took him away and, you know, lynched him and brutally, brutally murdered him. And then his mother had an open casket funeral. And the picture was so horrific that that started the civil rights movement, or one of the cases that really triggered the civil rights movement. And so Dan was there, 23-year-old Dan was there as a reporter. He covered it he was there for 5 days that the trial happened. And everybody in the room knew that the two murderers, they knew that the murderers did it, and they knew that the murderers would be acquitted. And so they were, you know. Took the jury about 67 minutes to say not guilty, and off they went. And Dan wrote an article about that, covering that story, that trial. And the first sentence was, "Oh, you did put me on the spot. I wasn't." You know, let me think. Okay, I know. I got it. So the first sentence of the article is, "The crowds are gone, and this Delta town is back to its silent, solid life." That is based on cotton and the proposition that the whole race of men was created to picket.
Yeah.
I think that was it.
Yeah.
So he wrote that, you know, he was really proud of that. He said, "I never wrote anything better since."
Yeah. Every time I saw him speak, he would recite that favorite sentence of his. But he has written so many wonderful sentences. His final book, which I think he mentioned all of us in the credits of that final book, was a second person story, which is almost impossible to write as a writer. I want to tell you, when you put the reader in the book, which is what he did. Okay. Now you're a child. Now you're a child going and joining the Boy Scouts. Now you're a child going. I mean, it was written second person, which probably I'm a nerd. Forgive me, but it's impossible to write a good book that way. That book is fantastic. It makes you understand what Kurt Vonnegut was and how he became Kurt Vonnegut Jr., the author of Slaughterhouse-Five and Breakfast of Champions and the creator of Kilgore Trout and all of these amazing things that Vonnegut became. Dan made you that. And that book, I just love it. And that was his final book. And forgive me, I can't remember the name of it. But that's what you're doing now with your film. You're making the viewer Dan Wakefield. And while it's not written in the second person the way that book was, you are taking people on this journey of befriending or being befriended by James Baldwin, who, you know, everybody that, you know, you get to know people, icebreakers, who would you like to have lunch with if you could have lunch with anyone? James Baldwin is on my list, right? You're taking us on the journey of his lifetime where he didn't know he had racist understandings. He didn't know he had racist tendencies. He didn't know that white people don't get it on a lot of issues. He didn't know that men don't get it on what it's like to be anything but a white man, right? And you take us on that journey. And that's the gift that he gave readers about Vonnegut. I just think that's kind of cool. So you're talking about future projects. What are you going to, do you have ideas? I mean, can we get a sneak peek in?
Well, we talk about many things, you know. Basically, you kind of try to build on your body of work and kind of like continue building on that body of work on using your past experience. And so if we look at the, you know, beyond the bridge that was under the bridge, then there's beyond the bridge. The next logical thing in that track would be to, and we've had quite a few folks talking about it, asking about it, is to do a film that is not specifically about homelessness, but still on that adjacent subject of affordable housing, because housing, just the place to live in America, has become so ridiculously unaffordable, not just for the lowest of the society, the poorest, but, you know, you listen to some of the cops and teachers who live in California, they have to live a couple hours away from where they work. You know, they have to ridiculous commutes just because they can't afford it. So large numbers of people in America just can't easily afford a place like they used to back in the day. So just kind of like expanding this topic to more affordable housing overall. That's one idea. Another one is, as Don said, you know, continue on with the racism. Just take a fresh look at this whole thing and try to give people a perspective what it is that, you know, we're dealing with here. Because, you know, you listen to one side that says everybody's a racist. You listen to another side, everybody says, no, it's no longer an issue. But I think that we have a knack for kind of like looking at things slightly differently than most documentary filmmakers and presenting it in a way where people are like, oh, I don't think I have much to say now.
Yeah. So that's an interesting concept, really, especially right now, where sort of the public trends, the trends that are being pushed officially or however, whatever words I'm supposed to be using that I'm failing me. Let's just stop talking about that. What about the good things about slavery? No one ever talks about the good things about slavery, right? Yeah. Well, you know, my answer is it's because there was absolutely nothing good about slavery, but that seems like an easy answer. But these are the things that are being articulated out loud that we're all supposed to just sort of, there is great fear that the African-American Museum in the Smithsonian will cease to exist. It's unconscionable to me, but they're actually talking about this. They're taking exhibits, the Rosa Parks exhibits, away. So it sounds like defining racism for people who aren't at that woke stage yet might be a great documentary. And I think this is where your final gleam on your halos comes from. Is if I were doing the work you two were doing, I'd be pissed off like every minute of every day. And you may, as you know me very well, think I already am. But you do this with grace and like it's just got to be done. And how does that happen? How do you stare at the soft underbelly? I know, Tim, you've been going through pictures of the Ku Klux Klan news articles in Indiana.
Yes, I was sitting at the Disney World down in Orlando looking at those giraffes out of the corner of my eye. But on the laptop, I was looking at, you know, the hooded people, unbelievable amount of Klan members in Indiana back in 1920s. Yes. So I'm sorry.
How do you stay calm? And you too, Don, how do you stay calm in this? And you're seeing these. You were showing me sentences in those articles that people are saying today, which is also kind of frightening.
How do we stay calm? I don't know if I have an answer to that. Don, do you have an answer? How do we stay calm?
I think for me, I kind of feel guilty about this. It kind of fascinates me, the whole racism thing. It kind of, you know, the dynamics of it. I think people, they're completely blind and unconscious to how generations after generations after generations determine how people act today. And what fascinates me is like those people that are trying to make slavery a positive thing. They gained a trade that they could carry on, you know, that kind of thing. I think that particular attitude is just in this time, but that would be the slave owner attitude too. That whole attitude survived from then until now. And so I think people can't successfully deal with or understand racism without making these connections. A lot of people, because there's a blind eye cast to it, which is all that's happening today, they're trying to blind white America from the history so that they don't understand why they act the way they act. They're justifying these behaviors that say you have just as much opportunity as I have, you know, or there's no, you have no problems. And then it becomes, well, what is this Black Wall Street? Oh, that's a myth. That never happened. You know, neither did the Holocaust, nothing. You know, they are making it possible and easy for white people to completely deny the history and just be okay. And therefore no guilt, don't owe you anything. And the next thing they're going to go after is privilege. We're not privileged. There's no privilege. It's a systematic kind of thing. What they also don't understand, you know, with the recipients of this, what they also don't understand is that the people who are making this possible for you are Nazis. They're uber racists. They absolutely, where you don't understand anything, they understand everything. They are instituting an American system of apartheid and adding a Eastern European governmental system, and all of it is to keep America white, keep it white ruled, and keep that privilege that they deny stronger and more institutionalized than ever. So that's all fascinating to me, and I feel guilty about that it fascinates me, but I have no shot at looking at it normally, because, you know, I had a father who was a civil rights leader and a fire breathing badass, and then would create a home environment that shielded us from all of this. And he would make sure that we operated equally. And on top of that, he was a Quaker. So I grew up in a Quaker household, and I grew up with Quaker values, and I grew up in a Quaker community, and there's not very many Black people that are Quakers. So I grew up in basically a white community. I had no shot at being normal, not at all. And then when Tim and I partnered up, he's this absolute weirdo from Belarus that sees things in such a hypercritical way and comes up in the crevices of society and brings the things that are hidden in those crevices out into the open. Both of our backgrounds together, there's no shot that we're a normal film crew. There's no shot that we see anything normally. And there's really no shot at us doing normal things, because what feels to us to be normal and natural is way off the beaten path for the film industry, for activism, for all of it. You know, like, activism is characterized by anger and being pissed off. But I think we're activists as well as just filmmakers. I mean, I had to tell my family yesterday. They were asking me, you know, what? Here's what I do. I go around to communities and try to get mayors and county executives and some cases lieutenant governors and council people and all these people to work together to deal with their homeless problem and try to encourage them that they can do it. That's what I do. That's not a normal filmmaker activity. And most filmmakers are trying to get publicity. They're trying to, especially documentary filmmakers, are trying to get the PBS world and all this kind of stuff. And they're, you know, we just do things differently. And but anyway, as far as the racism thing goes, I think that your average white person doesn't want to be a Klansman and doesn't want to be a Nazi. I think what they're being deceived about right now is they do want to hang on, and this is a natural human thing, they do want to hang on to their privilege, and they see Trump and his regime as the way to do that. I don't think they understand fully the implications of what's going on today.
Yeah. Well, I can't recommend enough people go back and listen to your mom and your sister in an earlier one of the Secular Saint episodes where we interviewed them and talking about having MLK Jr. in your house regularly. And your sister said even when he wasn't there, his picture was on the wall. So she felt like he was always watching her. Mm-hmm. And just growing up with the life that you grew up with, people can kind of hear that from your sister and your mom's words. Mm-hmm. What I'm noticing from Max's brilliant concept of making a podcast where we interview people behaving decently in indecent times is that you're not normal for overall, but you're kind of normal for this group. Because whether it's Diane Davis or Gary Goldman or any of the other people we've talked to, you kind of do what you do because you have to. There's this burning desire inside you to be just decent. And I think that happens. This is another thing that Max is working on with his Patreon that's going to be a sub part of this, is there are ordinary people doing far more ordinary things than what you guys are doing, but they're also decent people. And so we really want to elevate that decency, you know, so that people realize this is how easy it is to be decent in this indecent time. And maybe I can be that next decent person. But so I really just want to say how absolutely grateful we are. I know you're up against a hard end on this show. How grateful we are that you guys are doing the work that you're doing and that you're looking in those tiny cracks, Tim and Don. You're overcoming what other people think you should or shouldn't be doing. And you're getting out there and showing us things. And I, if I can put in a request that might take 10 years to get to, I would love to see something about what's happening with the way that we have demonized migrants. And especially maybe from your point of view, Tim, as a person who came here hoping for a life that would be, you know, fun and challenging and where you could contribute, and having that be degraded in people's public opinions. I just want to say thanks and toss it to Max maybe. And thanks for joining us on the show.
Well, Tim, if you're tossing it to me, I was just thinking that I was going to kind of take a point of order or whatever and say, you also have done significant work related to the unhoused, and December 21st of this year, we are going to be where I am literally sitting right now in Denver, Colorado. So I kind of came through Denver on a massive trip that I can't even begin to describe, but stopped in Denver and have been connecting with some of those that we'll be working with on December 21st for the Homeless Remembrance Blanket Project display here in Denver. I got to visit a shelter for the unhoused here. They're doing amazing work, and it's just unusual and apropos that it would be during a time when we're doing an episode about the unhoused and the challenges they face. So I want to thank both of you for being with us today and sharing that, and encourage people to see the film. I really love the direction that it went. That shift that you had from the first movie where it was, this is horrible, to now let's get a solution, was really important.
Thank you very much. It's been our pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to Sacred Legions, hosted by Max Goler and Pat LaMarche. Original music by Jamie Calland. To hear archived episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service. You will learn more about people behaving decently in indecent times and about the nonprofit organizations they support. Don't forget to check out our merchandise shop. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions, LLC.